Coming up on today's show,
the music producer has to take into account the artist's goals. Absolutely first, foremost, the producer shouldn't even have a goal except for to help the artist get there.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, proud member of the Recording Academy, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on location in Las Vegas, my guest is a songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, film composer, and music producer. Plus, he even teaches music production at UNLV. He was an original band member in the Las Vegas production of Blue Man Group, spanning 18 years and playing 5 instruments. Previously, he had spent 7 years drumming with Wild Colonials, who were on Geffen Records, co-writing and recording 3 albums, and touring nationally. He has been recording artists for more than 20 years and is the son of the late jazz legend Chick Corea. You have been hearing a song that he is the artist, writer, and producer on called Save Me. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Thaddeus Corea.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you. I'm grateful that you made time to let me come by and sit and talk with you today.
Well, thank you. It's uncomfortable to talk about myself, but I heard your other interviews and I liked them so much I wanted to do it.
Awesome. Awesome. That means a lot. Let's get started by having you share first all about the song of yours that was just playing during the intro called Save Me.
Save Me is from a volume of songs that I had written a couple of decades ago in perhaps a more angry or emotional time of my life. And that one is just a turn of phrase. The artist sort of nom de plume that I used at the time was King Whistle. And the meaning being, I really wanted that artist, in quotation marks, to make music that you could whistle the melody. That it was simple, repetitive, and I really like lyrics, so I wanted the lyrics to be meaningful, but not overly complicated. I guess everybody has a different gauge for what's too complicated or not, or too much metaphor. But that song is simply about vanity and looking around the world and seeing so much horrible situations for people, homelessness and people with not enough money, and feeling some of it myself and saying, save me, to some unknown person or God or something, save me, but save me first. Like, put me in the front of the line.
Wow.
And that kind of vanity of thinking about how you want things for yourself, but you want them ahead of people who need them worse.
Wow.
So the protagonist, the character of the song is not particularly nice, not particularly me, but it is what he's saying.
So you said it was written at a time when I was, and you described the type of thinking that you did back then.
Yeah.
To be clear, it was also recorded then.
Most of it was recorded then, and then about 4 or 5 years ago, I dragged out the entire volume. And I wanted to freshen it, so I ran through it, remixed a whole bunch of tracks.
Wow.
My only rule was I didn't re-record any new vocals.
Mm.
Anything else was up for grabs, though.
So I should have introduced you then as a vocalist, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, film composer, and music producer.
Oh, well, you know, multi is good enough.
Multi-instrumentalist, one of the instruments can be your voice, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated. What a really cool thought to say, I want to write music that people can whistle along to. I've always been someone that whistles. My mom, once I left home, I miss you being around the house. I miss hearing you whistling all the time. And so it's very unique. I mean, my gosh, to be more than 12 years into the show, and honestly, I don't remember anyone ever sitting in the guest seat and telling me, I try to write music that people can whistle along with. So I think this is brilliant. I think this is very unique.
I'm glad you connect with it. And, you know, it's, I think that idea of whistle along or hum along was specific for me at that time because a lot of the music that I really, really connected with between, say, like the age of, I don't know, 13 and 25, you know, when we really, really connect with a lot of music that means a lot to us at the time and it doesn't go away, we keep that music with us. For me, embarrassingly so, I would love a song, just love it, but I wouldn't know the words. Mm. I could hum it, I could whistle it, I could la-la my way through it, but I didn't actually know the words. And it wasn't till I was in my beginning 20s that I started to go, gosh, I don't know the words. That's so embarrassing. Mm. I got to look these up. And I would look them up or listen closer and get the words and be like, oh. And that's when I really fell in love with Elvis Costello.
Mm.
And I love his lyrics. And then that branch of the tree of rock and roll brought me to other branches where lyrics were really important. And so it became important to me. So those two things mixed together.
Yeah, I think to have that realization that, hold on, there's something being said here. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this a great disservice by just being happy whistling or humming along with it.
Exactly, yes.
Wow, wow. You actually are a third generation musician. Do please tell us about growing up as the son of jazz legend Chick Corea and a musician at the same time.
Yeah, which can be wonderful and can be a problem. Because I was a musician and growing up and finding my way with music and learning music, my grandfather, my dad's father, was a musician his whole life, professional musician. He played in what would have been called dance bands at the time. He had his own, what they called orchestras, but it was really a dance band. And he knew music. He wrote arrangements. He taught myself and my sister to read music and sort of gave us very early clues as to what was important in music and what was not important. I can remember learning on trumpet. I played trumpet for a few years, 5 years when I was little. And my grandfather, one of his instruments, one of them, was trumpet. And I remember trying to play the notes on the page, and he was helping me with playing the notes on the page, but he also emphasized, make a beautiful sound.
Mm.
And it was like a wholly new thought to me. Like, wait, what? I actually can choose what kind of sound I make.
Yeah.
So he was a great influence over me. And of course, he was a great influence to my dad. And my dad was a great influence to me. He, just by being around his rehearsals, his gigs, being brought along into clubs.
Mm.
From the time I was, you know, able to walk pretty much, I was in nightclubs.
Wow.
From way, way, way back. I'm not sure it's, you know, recommended parenting to bring your 3-year-old into a smoky club.
But I mean, I was waiting as you were building up to it. I'm thinking he's going to say something like 12 years old, and to say from when I was walking, my gosh.
Oh yeah, for sure. I was there from very early. I'm not completely unattended. You know, my mom would bring us in, or my grandparents would bring us in. My grandfather and grandmother, his Chick's parents, were very, very devoted. They only had one child. They were very devoted to him, and especially in the years when he was playing clubs, nightclubs in Boston and New York, we would always go.
Mm.
And my grandfather would bring a little, like, General Electric cassette recorder, just terrible cassette recorder, with his little microphone that he would plug into it, and he would put it on the little cocktail table, and he would make sure that no glasses got put on the table to clink around and no ashtrays, and he would dutifully press record, record the whole set right on the little cassette with his on the little J card, mm-hmm. write exactly who was playing that night, the date. Wow. And he had stacks of these cassettes. And then as I got older, my job became, okay, you sit there, press record, make sure you, you know, mm-hmm. be quiet and record the show and write down.
Was he recording your dad because he was proud, or was it supposed to be kind of a reference?
Oh, pride. No wow. reference.
Wow.
Yeah. He just, he was, they were both just so incredibly proud. My dad never, to my knowledge, my dad never listened to those cassette recordings. Mm. Those were just for my grandparents and me and us. Yeah.
But as you were continuing your own musician journey, did you feel, is dad looking over my shoulder? Am I meeting his approval? Or was it, oh, Bruce, we got along. There was no worry about me that, you know, is he pleased with how I'm doing? Am I under the microscope?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So there was no microscope being held over me from his viewpoint. The microscope over me was held from my viewpoint. Mm. And I worried all the time, is he noticing me? Am I playing well enough? Am I good enough? All of those kinds of questions of self-doubt. My dad wasn't in the parenting picture really hardly at all, even though we always had a great relationship. It was always filled with love and affinity and really just good times, but it was infrequent. And if I saw him, if we were hanging out for, say, a week, I might not see him again for 9 months, 10 months, 11 months. My parents separated quite young. So my relationship with him from my side was quite often, especially being younger and then being a teenager and wanting approval, wanting validation, looking for that from not only my father, but Chick Corea in quotation marks, planetary jazz legend, wanting validation or something from that person. It became really pretty frustrating. Now I understand better that I'm old, but it became pretty frustrating that a lot of his viewpoint back towards me was things he would say maybe didn't satisfy my question, but he was trying to make a point.
Mm.
For instance, you know, I would ask play something for him that I was involved in, like some band I was playing in, and play him a little bit of it. And I'd say, you know, like, what do you think? How did it sound? And he would say, what do you think? That's very hard for a teenager to take. That's very hard for an artist to take who's looking for validation from not only the artist, Chick Corea, but also the father, Chick Corea.
Not only validation, but you're also looking for his expertise to say, well, you know, I think what you should probably do, or what your band should probably do, or something I'm not hearing, you know, you're hanging on it and you're going, that's it? That's all you got for me? What do I think?
No, none of you. It. Ever. None of it.
Did
ever.
You ever play with him at any point?
Sure. Yeah. We would play and jam.
I mean play as like part of one of his shows.
No.
Not around the house.
No.
Hey, my son's here tonight. I'm going to bring him up on stage for a few songs. No.
No.
Hmm.
So his approach to answering my questions, I can see now, was meant for me to develop my own a bulletproof viewpoint of what I think is good.
Interesting.
Which is like, it is what you are as an artist, is what you think is good.
Mm.
That's what you are as an artist. You even asking other artists when I work with them, you know, hey, what band are you into? Or like, what song do you like, or what band do you imagine your band would open for or play with? Those viewpoints of what the artist thinks about themselves, what they like, that is who they are.
Yeah, that's important.
It's incredibly important. So he gave me that alongside of the frustration of not directly answering my questions.
Yeah, and now that you just gave those examples, if someone came in here and you're producing them and they finish and they look at you and go, what do you think? Like, don't worry about what I think. You know,
that's exactly right.
Are you guys happy with it? You know, do you think you have a better one in you? You know, those kind of things.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you mentioned that you'd come to him, you know, maybe you were performing with someone else. I mentioned this back in the intro. Share more with us about being a band member and co-writer with Wild Colonials, who I had said were on Geffen Records.
We had such a great time. So this was approximately 92 to 99. And record companies from 92 to 99 are, I would say, experiencing the last throes of success doing things the way they have done for decades, right before it all pretty much crumbles mm-hmm. in 97, 98, 99. And I started my relationship with Wild Colonials as a mercenary. I was just a drummer that got hired mm-hmm. to go out on tour and play with this band. And I listened to the album. I said, of course, I can do that. That sounds interesting. The band had a violinist, which I thought was weird, but ended up being very cool. The band had really eclectic sense of aesthetic. And the lead singer, Angela McCluskey, had such a beautiful tone of voice and such a deep connection to her emotion about each and every song. So I knew something good was going to happen. So I went out on the road with them. And we toured as bands tour at that level. You know, you're in a van, you're moving your own gear, you're stuffing things into the back of the van. You're fighting about who's going to drive the next 200 miles. And it was just fantastic. After the first year, we would often get together and jam in the backyard, in the hotels. And I played guitar as well. And they must have found something valuable about what I was contributing to those jams. They officially asked me to be part of the band.
Mm.
And I, of course, said yes, because I was super excited about it. And we kept going. It was a lot of fun.
You were living where at the time?
L.A.
So they were, all of them, I assume, were based in L.A. Said, okay, now let's go conquer the world.
Yeah, we were all based in L.A. Angela is Scottish, and it took me approximately a year to actually be able to understand what she was saying. And even beyond that, she is a Glaswegian from Glasgow, and the people from Glasgow just have the most fantastic, biting sense of humor and flourished language. They're the way they say things. It's the best.
Did you understand at the time that the band was signed to Geffen Records what a big deal that was?
No.
Or was it we were young, we're just like, okay, cool, what are we having for lunch?
Yeah, no, I didn't know or even know that I should know. No, I just knew we were going on tour and the music was fun and these people were fun. Sure, let's do it.
We become older and wiser, do we not?
Yes, we do.
Folks, I hope you heard my interview last week with Zoe Thrall, who is the Director of Studio Operations at the Hideout Recording Studios here in Las Vegas. I said during that conversation that what is now the week after next, June 4, 5, and 6, I will be in Quincy, Illinois, speaking at the Inklight Festival. They are calling it a literary festival of craft, cinema, and celebration, to include workshops, a film festival, and an awards gala. I'm going to take off my podcaster hat and do a presentation on how to partner with a publicist, which hopefully you know is my full-time role. Go to indiesunited.net And there was a banner across the top that you can click on to go to the festival page. You'll even see my picture on there as one of the speakers. I would love to see you in Quincy, Illinois for that event. Thaddeus, wow, 18 years playing for Blue Man Group and five different instruments at that. You could probably do an entire interview about all the time you spent in that role. Can you hit just a couple of highlights, meaning maybe how you got the gig in the first place, maybe what was the key to your longevity, and then maybe just one cool, fun story that sticks out.
Wow. I mean, oh, gosh. In the beginning...
Let me get comfortable.
my wife is a dancer and a choreographer, an associate director, and she has a lifelong connection with musical theater. And I have never had a lifelong connection with musical theater. My connection with musicals and musical theater would be like the great old movies with Gene Kelly. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know a lot. And I was looking for a gig, and she said, because she has done Aida and Rent and Tommy.
Wow.
She said, well, what about playing in a show, like a regular show? And I said, I don't know if I can do that.
Two of you living at this time?
We were living in L.A., but she was working in New York and around the world. Mm-hmm. But they didn't care that she lived in L.A. because they would fly her in. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know. I don't know if I can do it. I was reluctant. And then she called me. I think she was on tour in New York. And she called me and she said her friend's husband is one of the three original guys in this thing called Blue Man Group. And you really got to check it out because they have these drummers and the drummers are amazing. I said, well, okay, I don't know. And we went to the show in New York. The theater is very small. I don't really remember, but it couldn't have been, but I don't know, a couple hundred seats, very small, claustrophobic even. And it totally blew my mind. Mm. It was really, I was like, oh, these guys are just nuts. It was such a wild experience. And the drumming was so fantastic. I said, okay, yeah. Let me get involved. How do I get involved? Well, they're going to put a show together in Las Vegas and they're looking to expand. They're going to hire. So they're going to have auditions. Okay. I'm in. Let's go.
Wow.
So I did three separate auditions, two in LA, two in New York. I came to New York for training sessions.
Wow.
And then we opened up the Las Vegas show. Tracy was still on tour, my wife. So I packed up our house into a truck, our dog, our cat, drove to Las Vegas, found a place to stay, and we opened the show. And I I guess part of the story that's maybe relevant for, like, if I was telling this to the me that's younger and hadn't got the gig yet, I auditioned on drums. Mm-hmm. But while I was at the audition, they said, hey, do you play anything else? Well, yeah, I play some bass, some guitar. All right, here, why don't you put on the bass? I'd play some of that. Put on the guitar, play some of that. Put on the Chapman stick. What's a Chapman stick? I don't know. Okay, just you do it like this. Okay, I'll try it. Boom, try that. How about the zither? Zither, what's a zither? It's this instrument that Blue Man Group made, 86 strings, and it goes into a Marshall amp. Okay, I'll try it. So I tried them all. And they called me. I was in New York still. They called and said, okay, we want to offer you the gig. Thank goodness. Yay. Where? In Las Vegas. I thought, oh, I don't know. Because I wasn't really looking to go to Las Vegas. I thought, ooh, New York, how exciting would that be? But actually, the great gig was in Las Vegas. I just didn't know it. And then I said, well, what instrument? What am I playing? And they said, Chapman stick. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm a drummer. What do I know about Chapman stick? But therein began the next 18 years of my life playing all of the instruments. Mm. It was the best.
So what was the key to your longevity? Was it in large part the fact that you were able to play all those?
In small part, due to being able to play a lot of instruments. But mainly they did a great job casting. And they had great musicians, and they didn't want to get rid of them.
Mm, that's wonderful. I know it's difficult out of 18 years doing it, but is there one cool, one fun story that sticks out for a particular reason? And this was where, by the way, that was it always at the same venue?
No, we moved around from to a few different casinos, Venetian, Luxor. I think what I'll take away with me from the Blue Man Group experience, above any singular experience of playing four crowds, which is always the best, I'll take away the camaraderie of the band.
Mm.
The musicians were all great musicians without egos, and kind of each individually special. We weren't all exactly the same kind of musician. And somehow, by the luck of the draw, I guess, I don't know, or the foresight of the casting crew, we got cast. And I don't know, about 12 of us, 18 of us, something like that, you know, rotating through shows. These musicians, just so great, great friendships, and getting to play music that requires you to not just play the same thing every night. You have to look at the stage and react. And doing that reaction with the other guys in the band at the same time, we're all looking at the stage and we're all needing to react musically to things that are going on.
Wow.
Really creates a bond and a validation of your imagination of how you reacted. It's just a great time.
Was there ever anything about the anonymity and these costumes and, you know, the ego takes over and says, yeah, but nobody knows who you are, though. Don't you want people to know who you are? Don't you want them to know you're shaking your head? No, there wasn't.
No, totally not at all. I mean, really? Maybe that's just the nature of the band that was cast. Not one of us saw that as a detractive element. All of us saw that as an attractive element.
Wow. Wow, so cool. So we've been talking a lot about Thaddeus Correa, the performer, but let's shift over to the recording engineer education of Thaddeus Correa.
Well, I was always the guy in a band from the time I was in my teens. I was always the guy, well, I guess going back to jazz clubs for my grandfather, holding the little General Electric tape recorder.
Pressing the record button.
I was interested in that. It was fun. And, you know, making sure you had the right level. Later on, when I was like 9, 10, 11, I was doing tape dupes for my dad. And, you know, you have to watch the levels. And being 9, 10, 11 in that situation, really wanting praise or validation, really all you had to do was set the levels once and then go get an orange juice and relax.
Yeah.
I just sat there and stared at the levels and made sure and held on to those knobs. Oh, no, nothing's going into the red. And then later, I was always the guy in a band who wanted to record us and bought a four-track and a couple mics and started figuring out how to place microphones and how to do multi-tracking little by little.
Started figuring it out. Like, not went and got an education, not somebody taught you, not, it's just all kind of making it up as you go along. I'm holding up air quotes.
Absolutely making it up. I kept getting told, it only matters how it sounds.
Mm.
It only matters how it sounds. And I always thought that was silly. What do you mean? Give me the secret. Tell me the secret sauce.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. How does it sound?
Yeah. Yeah, and it kind of goes back to going to your dad and saying, "What do you think?" Well, what do you think? You know, I've got this microphone set up over here. It's a little bit different. I want to try it out. What do you think? Well, I don't know. Let's record it and see how it sounds.
Yeah.
Right?
it's so results based. You know, did you have the microphone? Was it a 57? Was it 2 inches away from the sound source? Was it 2.5 inches? Was it a 45 degree angle or was it 90 degree angle? I mean, they're all important things to remember so that you can repeat a successful recording.
Yeah.
But I learned them the dumbest way. I learned them by doing a lot of recordings terrible.
Mm. Yeah. So many artists nowadays want to just automatically downshift into self-produce mode. Mm. 4 weeks ago, on episode 636, I asked Chris Standring, one of the most prolific and successful artists on the contemporary urban jazz scene, if he gets moments of, I do produce, but this time I just want to be the artist. Thaddeus, tell us about the value of a music producer and what you bring to the table.
It's a good question, especially right now, because everybody has the software. Everybody can record themselves. Everybody can just record themselves, finish a song, put it up on Spotify, and say, look at me, I did it. You can absolutely do it. And I don't know what the numbers are, but the statistics on how many songs get uploaded to Spotify every day is staggering. And if we even take a rough guess, we'd probably say that a majority of it is not great.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you need a music producer? Why do you need a mixer? Why do you need anybody else? You need somebody else because they have experience, like helping you get to where you want to get to. I've run into artists all the time that are pretty okay at, they can record themselves, they can come up with some parts, they can like sort of finish a song. But that song could be like 100 times better with input from another person. That other person is the producer.
Yeah, because you said they're pretty okay at, and you said they can sort of finish the song. So pretty okay at and sort of finish add up to, all right, I know my limitations. I need to go to a producer and say, you do what you do because I can't do what you do. And there's so many things in this conversation, whether you realize it or not, to keep coming full circle, right? Well, how does it sound? So they think, you know, I'm pretty okay at this, and I sort of have it finished. Well, how does it sound, though?
Yeah.
You know, and even when you were talking about Blue Man Group and being able to react in the moment and that improv factor, you know, I had mentioned to you about the interview that I did with John Beasley back on episode 629, and John talked audience, please go and listen to that. A great conversation with John. He talked about Chick Corea, but John talked about, you know, the value of improv. And so these things that are recurring themes, I always say if something keeps getting kind of, you talked about that already. Well, maybe it's because it's important to reinforce,
mm-hmm.
you know, so improv and its value, but also as you're saying here, to realize that, how does it sound? Okay. I thought I could self-produce. I tried to self-produce. I need to go to Thaddeus Corea and say, would you like to produce me?
It's pretty hard to be an artist and have that kind of foresight. When you're a young artist, all of your friends think that you're a genius because you made a song and you put it on Spotify. Mm-hmm. And that is something far different than any of their friends can do, usually. And it's so cool, but it's not at a level that it could be. And a young artist doesn't maybe necessarily know, well, why do I need a producer? Like, I'm cool. I got it. Like, I mixed it. Okay. Well, you did, but this song could be so much more.
You did, but you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. You come in here. You sit with Thaddeus for an hour, for 3 hours, depending on what kind of a session it is, or maybe it's just a meet and greet. And even if it is a meet and greet, they're going to go, holy crap, this guy knows all kinds of stuff that I had no idea about.
Yeah. There's being a music producer has, I think, a problem-solving side to it, which is less creative. Like, the person sends me tracks to mix, and the bass doesn't sound great. That's a problem. I know how to solve the problem, so I solve it. Not very imaginative. Another situation that's more imaginative is the song is finished, but it just doesn't ever kind of really pop, or there's some awkward spots in it, or like doesn't feel like it's a real finished thing. Like, what's going on? Well, could it be that the producer, me, I recognize that the artist, their strongest vocal section is in this range, but for some reason they just happen to have made the song 5 whole steps lower. So they never produce that strong, beautiful range with their voice in this song. They just never thought to change the key to what's good for them. Or maybe using the same part over and over throughout the song actually just kills interest. But they don't know that, because that's part of years of experience of trying to get people to not press fast forward to the next song. Mm.
Well, and you being a drummer, you know, they may use programmed drums on whatever software they're using, and they bring it to you. And not only do you say, you're going to hear a big difference if we use real drums, but you say, what if we put Cajon on this song? And they're going to go, oh, well, really? And you, in your experience, they go, oh, I can hear it already. And they don't get it. But now all of a sudden, these are the ideas you're bringing to the table creatively. And they're going, wow, that actually does make a big difference.
Sure. I think that music producers, who pretty often are also songwriters, I mean, I have my own songwriting personality, or what that person does, and that's songwriting. I think music producers have to be good at recognizing the components of great songs, and that's what they help an artist get to. You know, it's very true for me in, I don't know, 20, 30 years of recording people and bands doing songs, that it is very hard to ruin a great song. Mm. You can record it terribly. You can do all the mistakes in the world, you know, the wrong effects. You can't ruin a great song.
Wow.
But you can't polish a terrible song. You can't make it great.
Well said. Well said. I am joined today on location in Las Vegas by songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, film composer, and music producer Thaddeus Correa. Visit his official website at thaddeuscorea.com. I will put a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. He is on Instagram and LinkedIn, and there's even an IMDb page for him. You can also go on Spotify to find a playlist of tracks produced, engineered, and mixed by Thaddeus. Earlier, I was saying that I will be in Quincy, Illinois in a couple of weeks. That being said, since I regularly say on this show that I would love to meet listeners of Now Hear This Entertainment to say a face-to-face thank you for listening to the podcast each week, I do realize that I cannot be everywhere, and so in an effort to connect with audience members in locations I will not get to, I invite you to join me online for a virtual coffee. On my podcast website, nhte.net, there is a bright yellow Buy Me a Coffee button that will allow you to do exactly that. Well, you can buy more than one if you're so inclined. You'll see others before you who have done so, the messages that they have written to me there, as well as the replies that I posted back to them. It's a nice way for you to let me know that you appreciate the work that I am doing with this show every week, every month, more than 12 years now. Thaddeus, before all that, you were talking about being a music producer. Share with us a bit about the hat that you wear as an educator teaching music production at UNLV.
Sure. It's a recent addition. In the last year, I started teaching drums and other instruments at a small music school, Rare Sparks, here in Las Vegas. And then the opportunity came up to teach music production at UNLV. I have taught some, I guess you would call it like a master class, where I invite people here into the studio and I teach them something specific, like how to mic drums or how to mix, how to record vocals. So teaching is just, it's not for everybody, I guess. But I really, really enjoy teaching young artists how to do these things, because they really can do a lot of these things themselves. Mm-hmm. Even if a young artist could do all of the technical things that I could possibly teach, how to use the software, all of the shortcuts, all of the ways to record and use mic preamps and microphones and mic placement and rooms and all of those things, those are all technical. That artist still benefits from having a music producer, because the role of the music producer still valid in finding the best thing for that artist that the artist can't see while they're being the artist.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if subconsciously it was, boy, I would have loved someone like me in 2026. I would have loved someone like me way back when I was just kind of figuring it out as I went along, in terms of this education that you didn't get, that now you're making available formally teaching music production.
I don't know. I guess I think it's just very possible. It's really possible to learn how to use the software, how to use everything technical in a recording studio. It's not really rocket science. It is a lot. There's a lot to it. There's an incredibly long list of details. Being a recording engineer kind of lends itself to being OCD. It's a great combination. But I think it's doable. And I want other artists and young artists, young engineers, to have all that, because that's just the starting block.
Mm.
Then you're going to write a song. Now we're talking about stuff that is really interesting to me. You're going to write a song with lyrics, and it has to communicate and has to bring an emotion to a recipient. It has to arrive. It has to make the person not want to press fast forward. They want to hear it. They want to hear what happens next. They stay interested. Like, those questions are very, very interesting to me, and not as easy to teach as, you know, this is how you plug in a microphone.
Stay there, though, because I want to hear about the value of a great song and the goal of a great song.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, right? That I don't think it can be automatically answered, because I think each artist has a different goal with their art. I don't think that John Coltrane wanted the same thing by A Love Supreme that, you know, Iggy Pop wanted as I Want to Be Your Dog. Different goals, but both extremely valuable. And the music producer has to take into account the artist's goals, absolutely first, foremost. The producer shouldn't even have a goal, except for to help the artist get there.
Except, how does it sound?
How does it sound?
I'm saying that half-kiddingly, which means that I'm half-serious.
No, it's serious, for sure.
But, you know, I like that value proposition, because it's kind of like when I'm starting with a new publicist client, I will say, okay, where are we trying to go with all this? Like, what are your goals and objectives? You know, because it also gets into that conversation about, we all have a different definition of success. And I think even with some authors that I've worked with, I see a lot of similarities between music clients, where you do get the person that says, I'm just recording this music because I just want to have something to show people that I recorded. Before you and I started recording, I was talking about the music studio that I went to, the recording studio, when I first started Now Hear This Entertainment. And he had someone that used to come in there who was a dentist. And I'm not going to leave being a dentist. I just want to record some music, right? Which is very different from the person that says, what do you mean, what am I recording? What is my goal? I want to go on tour, and I want to sell a lot of music, and I want to be a household name, all that kind of thing. So I think that's important. And that's probably another reason why, if you stay in your bedroom and record yourself, you're not going to have these conversations. You know, you're going to just say, you may know what the goal is, but you may say it because that's what you think. And if you talk to a producer who kind of gets you to take those blinders off, say, well, what else though? You know, and kind of pull that out of you.
For sure.
I think it's a great exercise that has nothing to do with how good a player you are.
I agree. I think that's another value of the music producer, is if I, as the artist, wanted to go get a music producer to push myself even further than I could possibly push myself, so I get this music producer, he or she is going to ask me questions that make me think about my own art and, well, you know, where do I want to go or what, how do I want to be perceived? You know, do I want to write lyrics that are important or do I want to write lyrics that are, you know, barely legible? All kinds of questions about how, where you want to arrive. And it's important for the producer to see how great I can be. The producer can see how great the artist can be. It's very hard for the artist to see how great they can be all the time.
Wow.
We do terrible things to ourselves as artists. Like, I'm not good enough. I'll never be that good. I can't do this. I can't sing that note. I don't do this. You know, you destroy yourself as an artist. You need somebody. The music producer looks at you and goes, man, that artist has strengths here, here, and here. So that's where we're going to push and help that artist expand those things that are wonderful about them. I think it's an important thing to look at people and see what's great about them, and see the greatness in other people.
Wow. Ooh, good stuff. Good stuff. With all due respect to your dad and your grandparents, there's someone else with the Korea last name that you hinted at, but I want to bring this deep into the conversation now. Tell the audience about the experience and result of writing a full-length rock musical with your wife.
Yeah. Okay. Writing a full-length rock musical is not for the
faint
of heart, and doing it with your wife is not for the faint of heart. My wife is demanding and picky, and she knows what she wants, and she wrote the story, and so she had this story. She came to me and she said, you know, I want to write this musical and I'm going to need somebody to help me writing the music. And being competitive, I thought, well, I don't want somebody else to do this. I want to do it. But up to that point, I had really written rock, indie, alternative, all adjacent to rock. And my familiarity with musicals that I loved was also actually rock-based in The Who's Tommy and Jesus Christ Superstar. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I loved both of those albums. And when she said, would you want to get involved? And I said, yes, I want to get involved. My vision had to do with guitars, loud guitars. So her experience and history was different musicals that are piano-based. And so it was a lot of trying to convince her that this could be good, this could be good. And then she would get excited about it. And it was much more work than I thought. It ended up being 22 songs. And it's an incredible amount of work to write a musical, because you write the song, and it's not like a rock and roll song where you're trying to get a groove and a vibe, and like the lyrics are important, but maybe this section, I'm going to just repeat the lyrics. No, in a musical, you're trying to relay information about the story that's incredibly important, and you're probably not going to say it twice. So it has to be heard. It has to be clear. So I learned a ton about songwriting for musical theater through that experience. And we ended up with stuff that I think is just really great. In the end, it's fantastic.
Is this present day, or did something already come of it?
We put it up in a very small fashion, just so we could hear it. I guess you would call it staged readings, so that we could hear it, see it, to a small number of audience members. I mean, I'm talking like 20, 25, just to get a sense of it. And then just other things came up in life. We haven't gone further with it.
Yeah. The time will be right. It's percolating right now. Speaking of your wife, what is this about starting, growing, and selling $1 million Amazon business with her?
Well, you know, got to do what you got to do. Tracy started an Amazon business. She thought, you know, we need some kind of business to just bring in money so we can just be artists and not have to worry so much about how much we get paid for the art that we do. Totally reasonable idea, I thought. And then she got learning about Amazon businesses. This would have been like 2014, 15. And she said, you know, we got to check this out. Like, I think we can do this. And I said, really? Okay. So then I started checking it out and we learned a lot about, well, okay, this is how you start an Amazon business. And then we had to pick a product and figure out what would be a smart product. What do people need? And for whatever reason, we tried out a bunch of ideas and we decided on one. We had a company named CarterJet that made watch bands specifically for Apple Watches. At a time when, for me as a musician, looking at audience members file in and out of a theater, looking at people like on an airplane when I was traveling, there'd be like one person wearing an Apple Watch out of 100, out of 200. It was very new. People weren't crazy about Apple Watches at first. It was new. So we thought, we got a timing on this. We're doing it.
Oh, I see.
So
I
we started selling these Apple Watch bands, and we got in early. It was just great, great timing. We made designs and all kinds of things, and the company boomed, and it got to be so much work that we looked at each other at one point and said, if we could sell this business, would you? And so we contacted a broker and said, how much is this business worth? And when he told us, we said, we made a decision that we would sell the company and put effort back into our art because we would have some time.
Interesting. Wow. As much as you have spent so much of your life in music, there's something that I sense you're just as happy, if not more so, to talk about, which is fatherhood. Can you reveal for us, you hinted at this a little bit at the start of our conversation, can you reveal for us about realizing what you were not given in mentorship and trying to provide it for your sons?
That's absolutely true. I didn't really think about it specifically until I said that to you. But it's true. What I lacked in mentorship in my, well, as a kid, and then in my teens and 20s, very specifically, I realized that's what I'm here to do. And it gives me great, great joy to have two sons who, you know, still love us, still talk with us, still involved with us. They haven't just, you know, run away. And it's really no end of joy for me to have a family. And it's weird, though, because in my teens, I wasn't really planning a family. It wasn't like a goal of mine, like, hey, one day I'm going to have a family and I'll have grandchildren one day. And it was absolutely not a goal of mine. I wanted to be a musician, nothing else. So finding Tracy and then entertaining her goal of having a family, entertaining it for myself and going, well, I don't know, I guess. I mean, it's important to her. And would I have a family? I was scared about it. My father was gone for a lot of my childhood. That's not good. My experience was like, well, I don't know about this whole thing. But then it was sort of like, look, that's what her goals are. And if I can't get with it, it's not going to happen. So I did. I got with it. And I can't believe what an incredible, powerful joy being a father has been for me. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say, you looked at it and said, well, gosh, I don't want this to turn out to, oh, I just have to make sure that I do it the way I wish it had been. How old are your sons, and do one or both of them do music?
I have a 24 and a 22, and one of them is a wonderful guitar player and guitar teacher, and the other is a finance research analyst.
Outstanding. Outstanding.
And it's such a joy for me to hear my guitar player son play guitar in his bands and stuff and recordings he's doing. He's got his own studio in his room. But also, he started teaching guitar a few years ago, and I got to just sort of peek in the room while he was teaching. And he is such a wonderful teacher, so patient and tolerant and caring. It's amazing. I don't know where he got it. It's fantastic.
We're going to close today with a song that Thaddeus was the producer, drummer, bassist, guitar player, and mixer on, one called Just Enough by Michael Lewis Austin. Before I let you go and we play that track, Thaddeus, share with us first all about this one, if you would, please.
Well, Michael Lewis Austin is a wonderful artist, and we had been friends for a little while, and he came to me and said, you know, would you like to produce a couple songs of mine? I said, yeah, sure, okay. I said, like, what is your imagination of, you know, what is your style? What do you want to do? Because he had recorded an album, which he liked, but he felt like could have been much more. And then he had more songs. He's a type of songwriter who's just constantly writing songs. He had more songs. When I asked him about what his influences were, he said things like Tom Petty, Radiohead. He gave a few examples of sounds that were a little bit alternative and a little bit pop, but certainly not very country. But then he played me some of the songs, and I just kept thinking, like, that the artist does not realize that he's singing a country song. So we played around with a lot of styles to find what was resonating for him. Like, I would produce one song and sort of lean heavily towards Radiohead with things that I knew would contribute to that style. And then we would try something else and lean a different way until he felt comfortable, and we realized that where he was comfortable was what he calls y'alternative. So it's alternative country. It's not mainline country, mainstream like country. You know, he's not born and raised in Nashville, but they are songs that have a story and songs that have a lyric that are very important. Like, it all makes sense with country. And when we put in some elements, like some steel, yeah, there's even a banjo, ukulele, there's some string elements that tip their hat to country music, but don't push him over there completely. I could tell he resonated more with that. And so we found our style and we produced the rest of the album that way.
Yeah, I remember when you sent me the songs and I played that one second. And so as a result of having listened to the other one first, all of a sudden I played that one and I went, oh, like in a good way, but okay, this is very different. Now, granted, the first one was you, the second song is him. But the fact that it did lean country got my attention. And this is fascinating to hear that, you know, there was talk of, you know, well, maybe Radiohead. It said, like, you're trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Like, come on,
sure.
Let's get you where you're supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, as artists, we're all pretty complicated. And I can love Stravinsky, but please don't produce my album as a classical album. So he loves Tom Petty and Radiohead. And as the producer, you have to find out, well, okay, you have to think, well, why does the artist love that? The artist loves it for, and you figure out what it is, and then you listen to the artist's songs, and you're like, oh, okay, so let me see how all of these things can be true at the same time.
Wow. Well, dare I say, this in itself has been a bit of a masterclass. Wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for opening your door to me. Thanks for letting me come by. Thanks for spending time with me. It's great to have you on Now Hear This Entertainment.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, film composer, and producer Thaddeus Correa. Do visit his official website at ThaddeusKorea.com. As I mentioned earlier, I will have a link for it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. Remember that he is on Instagram and LinkedIn, and that there is even an IMDb page for him. Plus, as I mentioned earlier, you can also go on Spotify to find a playlist of tracks produced, engineered, and mixed by Thaddeus. And please let him know that you heard him on Now Hear This Entertainment. That will do it for episode 640. Thanks ever so much for listening. I will send you out today with a song from Michael Lewis Austin that Thaddeus did lots of work on. This is the one he just talked about. It's called Just Enough.
Another Saturday, sitting at home, trying to listen to a faraway place, lost in the memories that you've been missing. Another message sent out over the airwaves on a different wavelength. Suddenly a voice does shout, will I ever make it? Will I ever have the strength this time? Just enough to steal their attention. Just enough to change a life. Just enough divine intervention. When you wished for your life to be unencumbered, fate was on the other line, holding for destiny and lucky numbers. Regrets are wishing well that a broken heart will always hide in. Only time will tell, just another way for the clock to keep on lying to you. Just enough to change a life. Just enough divine intervention. Just enough to get it right. Cast your thoughts into the horizon. Twilight takes the regret, hoping to give you clear blue skies. And another message sent out over the airways on a different wavelength. Suddenly a voice does shout, will I ever make it? Will I even have the strength this time? Yeah.